I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to this discussion. We're about to talk with Gwen Ifill, who is, of course, the host and managing editor of The Washington Week, senior correspondent with the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, and has worked on many newspapers, including the Baltimore Sun in her past, and also has the joy of being first cousin to one of our frequent guests, Sherilyn Ifill. And Gwen Ifill, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hi, Mark. Now, you know I have to say it was the Baltimore Evening Sun, right?
That's right, which is long gone.
I know. We Evening Sun alums are very fierce about protecting the name of the
I should have been much more clear. I apologize. And now Gwen Ifill has come out with her first book, The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama. And it was a long time for your first book to come out, but this is worth waiting for, I might add.
Thank you.
One of the things that struck me as an kind of overarching feeling when I finished the book was that is the complexity of all this. It's not as simple to talk about, as you seem to point out, without really saying it, to talk about post-racial politics or racism in America or just race and class and the mixture of that with the battle between the young hip-hop generation of politicians and those in between and the gerontocracy is that was described by a professor at Spelman when it comes to the battle within the black political world. This is a very complex issue when you talk about the nature of race and politics in the 21st century.
It is. And one of the reasons I was actually happy to write this book is because in all the years that I've been covering politics, whenever race comes up, people tend to simplify. They tend to make it about Jesse Jackson or Al Sharpton. Or
right.
They make it about good or bad. They don't make it about all these many layers of change which are going on right under our noses, which we just haven't taken the time to chronicle properly.
So, but this has been a real sea change, and I think the sea change is fascinating because even though the people that you focus on in the book, in the chapters, are younger, there's also a world of difference between them in many, many ways. But it's a fascinating group that you've chosen to kind of focus on directly, like Arturo Davis, of course, President Barack Obama, but Arturo Davis and Cory Booker and Deval Patrick, starting with them. I mean, they're all three very different political characters.
They are. And at first blush, you look at them and they seem to have a lot in common. They have Ivy League backgrounds and three of the four of them actually were raised by single mothers. And many of them are lawyers, and they seem as if they have taken their kind of elite upbringing and transformed it into something which is their version of public service, which is all true. But then when you you peel back the onion, you find out that there are a lot of differences. And the differences mostly come down to policy. But the similarities are part of what fascinated me. Everybody I talked to, these four as well as dozens of other what I call breakthroughs, who I talked to, all of them had to answer the same kinds of questions. They were all told originally it wasn't their turn yet, they should step aside and wait. Each of them tells me separately that they were told that they weren't black enough at first by members of the black community. Many of them had to take on entrenched black politicians rather than entrenched white politicians that their parents maybe would have had to fight with. Their idea of changing the world was not about getting laws passed or sitting in at lunch counters, because they didn't even know what lunch counters were by the time they came along.
That's true.
It's true.
That's true.
But they have a different way. They still want to change the world, but they're doing it through making use of the laws that their parents made sure got enacted. So it's a very interesting, different way of thinking about race and politics than we've been trained to do.
I'm going to take some of the things you talked about in the book and that you've also just outlined, because I think that it's just fascinating to me what we've come to, and I appreciate you beginning of your book talking about your time, The Evening Sun, and the Billy Murphy campaign that I had the fortune or misfortune to be associated with back then when you were covering it.
Now, you only lost. That's
really?
All that went wrong.
What a loss. But I'm still friends with Billy, so it was very funny. But the idea of not your turn yet and not black enough is not solely a black and black issue. I mean, when you talk about not black enough, I mean, this is something that a lot of these people you write about have been painted with from the black and the white side.
Well, you know, I don't know that it's really... I find that white people are more likely to say someone is too black, which actually, and the answers for both of those kind of broad brushes is the same, which is black folk who ask whether somebody else is black enough are basically saying, who are you? Are you on my side? Are you speaking for me? Will you sell me out? White voters who ask whether someone is too black are asking the same question. Will you only represent your people? Will you leave me by the side? Will you speak to me? In order to overcome any of those kind of broad brushes, all of these candidates have to prove to both sides, all sides, I should say, because this goes beyond just black and white. It goes to gay and straight and Latino and Asian. They have to prove to everyone that they are more like them than unlike them. And when you stop and think about it, that's what every politician has to prove in order to win election. No one votes for someone who they think will not represent their interests. That's what politics is all about. So when you take the layer of race and put it on top of it, that's what black enough and too black and white enough, if anyone ever asked that, which no one ever does. That's what that means.
So, but I suppose I was thinking about how on the one side you have a paragraph talking about Joe Biden when he made the comment about clean and articulate, and Bill Clinton talking about Obama's record being a fairy tale and comparing mm-hmm. his electoral victories to Jesse Jackson's, and McCain, none of us will forget, pointing to Obama and saying that one.
Mm-hmm.
That those things were, it's so hard because they were so blatant, yet weren't seen as blatant by so many people.
You know, part of the problem for each of the three people you name is that they walked right into a morass that they were not aware of. I don't think either of those guys in their conscious mind said, I'm going to tar him. I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that's what Joe Biden was thinking. I don't believe that's what John McCain was thinking. And I don't really think on many levels that's what Bill Clinton was thinking. What they were, however, was speaking in each of those three cases out of a sense of frustration that they couldn't somehow pierce what it was about this guy that other people found appealing. When you think about it, John McCain was frustrated in the middle of the debate that this guy, who he was trying valiantly not to call by name so as not to elevate him,
mm-hmm.
was getting so much, he thought, good press. The same thing, that was the same frustration that drove Bill Clinton. And in its own way, that was the same frustration that drove Jesse Jackson, even, when he criticized him. Barack Obama. So I guess we could debate till the cows come home whether there was subliminal racism that drove these comments, but I think it was more about frustration about how do you beat this guy, and that's what each of them found themselves running up against. I mean, Joe Biden thought he was paying the man a compliment.
Yes.
A lot of white people think it's a compliment to call someone articulate. You only have to be a black person to realize that if you turn that on its head, you realize that no white person ever gets called articulate unless they are illiterate, and unless it is a surprise that you can speak the king's or the queen's English.
Right, so, they might call a white heavyweight boxing champion articulate.
They might.
They might.
They don't usually.
They might. Yeah. Maybe not. Now, though, going beyond that, I mean, one of the things that's so fascinating about this is that in the beginning, when you show the statistic that 30% of all elected African American officials are now from multiracial districts. And that people like Arturo Davis clearly did that in the South,
yeah,
in Birmingham, Alabama.
I find, you know, this title of Barack Obama's second book was The Audacity of Hope.
Yes.
I think Arturo Davis absolutely represents, is the emblematic of the audacity of hope. The idea that he, a 40-year-old black man, son of a single mother, wrong side of the tracks, you name it, should want to next year run for and thinks he can win the governorship of Alabama, which in my lifetime, a seat that was occupied by George Wallace,
mm-hmm.
the cradle of the Confederacy. Now, there are a lot of numbers and polls which show this is a steep slog for him uphill. But once again, Arturo Davis fits into this mold of someone who does it even though people tell him it's not his turn. And sometimes they lose the first time and they try a second time. He got elected to Congress only by running twice for the same seat and unseating an entrenched black incumbent he was never supposed to beat. So it is fascinating to watch these things unfold. I mean, just since this book hit the stands, there have been so many ways I could update it. There's so many things I could say which had not happened before. Kendrick Meek, a congressman from Miami, is now running for the U.S. Senate. Kamala Harris, the district attorney in San Francisco, is now running statewide for attorney general. And, of course, Mayor Dixon was indicted after this book was
published. Yes, right.
So many things have happened that you get the sense that this is a very slippery, unfolding situation, which is worth keeping a thumb on just because it keeps shifting. I had the problem while I was writing the book. I looked up one day, I thought I was writing a chapter about the only black governor in the country when I was writing about Deval Patrick, and I turned on the TV and there was Eliot Spitzer resigning. And all of a sudden we had another black governor. So it's a very lively story, and one which is still unfolding even as we speak. I'm scared to look at the TV. Who knows what's going on?
Who knows what's going to change? And you, the people you're talking about, though, when you write briefly about Bakari Sellers in South Carolina,
mm-hmm.
and I just finished interviewing the guy who wrote Capital Men, and a mm-hmm. lot of it took place.
Philip Dre, yeah.
Yeah, Philip Dre, incredible book. And some of it took place in South Carolina. I think of Bakari Sellers, the son of Cleve Sellers,
mm-hmm.
civil rights, the SNCC activist.
Yep.
And the place that first he makes his broad, as you quote him, about going beyond race and saying kind of bringing poor people together in a sense,
mm-hmm.
and talking about where class, how important that is. And this is a guy with a huge future. I mean, in South Carolina.
It's amazing. And he's 23 years old.
Yeah.
And his father and he don't necessarily disagree, even though his father came of age at a time when, you know, you did sit in at lunch counters and you were arrested for the things you believed in. His son looks at it and sees it far less race-driven than you would expect. But his father understands why. I mean, even Jesse Jackson Jr. and Sr. see the world differently. And Jesse Jackson Sr. says, well, his son is the negotiator and he is the agitator. They just have different world views about how to reach, in many cases, the exact same ends.
So I wonder how you think this could affect in the out years as Barack Obama is president and so many African-American elected officials are winning in racially mixed areas and in statewide, as Deval Patrick and others, that how that might affect the Voting Rights Act and the idea of racially whole districts. And I can see an argument taking place.
Well, it's interesting. Julius Chambers, who's one of the heads of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and was one of the architects of implementing the Voting Rights Act by carving out these districts to favor or to provide a leg up for black candidates in black districts, he says maybe we have to revisit this.
Mm-hmm.
And given the success of, as he called it, the Corys and the Obamas. And when you look at that, you really do think, wow, the door is being opened to a more nuanced idea about what black power is, how it's attained, and how it's held on to.
It's an interesting phenomenon happening. The people I interview from that generation of young black leaders in America, young leaders in general, but young black leaders in America, and as you write about them, there's this deep consciousness about being an African-American, but a very different view of what it means, A, to succeed and how to succeed, and how you cross racial lines. I mean, it's a really, I haven't quite put my hands around it just yet. You know, it's evolving, but it's a fascinating change in the kind of sense of race and racial dialogue. Not post-race, but something is changing on that. I don't know how, if you maybe put your finger on it much better than I.
Well, it's a hard one, because one of the things that we as people of a certain age have to figure out is we have to assume that the kids we've raised see the world a little bit more differently than we do. And we don't want to force down their throat the burdens of race that we grew up with. When I look at I have a 12-year-old godson who on the day that Barack Obama won was supremely unmoved by this. He just wanted to go play his video games. Well, couldn't say, but you ought to care about this. I didn't want to shake my finger at him because, you know what, he sees the world differently. The range of his friendships and the things he has access to, no one ever told him he couldn't have anything because of his race. And that's exactly what we wanted. We wanted to raise children who all of a sudden had new opportunities. So you have to be careful. You want the balance is to raise children who recognize the politics, I mean, the values of difference in a positive way,
mm-hmm.
but aren't burdened by it in the way that perhaps we have been. And to understand that that's a perfectly good way and to live in many ways what we've all aspired to.
There is an interesting new lineup happening with all of this as I watch some of these people. I'd like to kind of outline some of the folks that really weren't major players in your book but that you talked about that I think that just because they're so interesting in their perspective and how they've come up and how they've grabbed hold in the communities. And you mentioned the woman just a moment ago, the district attorney from San Francisco, mm-hmm. Kamala Harris.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who's Asian and African American mix.
Mm-hmm.
I just found that her whole sojourn, as I've been reading about her even more since your book, is very fascinating, where she might take herself.
Well, it's fascinating in part because she doesn't speak in a traditional Democratic way. She identifies as African American, not as anything else. It's pretty mm-hmm. clear about that. She is she grates at the notion that people like to call her the Black Obama because she's the female Obama because they think that she thinks it's a pretty lazy way of characterizing who she is.
Right.
But they're trying to characterize her. They're trying to put her in a box because she is so unlike anything else we've seen. One of the things she is also, and you find this rarely, and it's why I had such a hard time finding black women to profile for this particular book, is that she's single and she doesn't have kids, which means she was able to focus on a political career in a way that a lot of African-American women and women in general have not been able to. Women in general choose to either wait to be asked or they wait until they've raised their children. Nancy Pelosi was a grandmother before she became Speaker of the House.
Mm-hmm.
Or they choose to pursue leadership in other ways, like in the nonprofit world. So that was a big challenge for me as an African American woman trying to find a way to write a story about breakthrough candidates and realizing there were just not that many African American women that I could profile who met the same category.
Though there are a number of them. I mean, and it's
there are
a number of them. And I also just a little sidebar here. I was fascinated in that little piece you wrote about where Artur Davis, recently victorious and recently defeated Barack Obama, met at a party. And
yes. Mm-hmm.
And
they met at a party that was being given by Harold Ford, who had run for Senate in 2006 and lost. Barack Obama had run for Congress and had finally been elected to the Senate. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I can't remember which year this party was, but for some reason, both Artur Davis and Barack Obama found themselves in a corner talking to each other.
Right.
Everyone else at this Congressional Black Caucus Party looked at them with some disdain because they had dared to take on black candidates and lost. It was earlier than 2006.
It was. I think your line in the book something was about they thought people might be pointing them saying that those are the looters over there.
Yeah, Obama had been beaten by Bobby Rush, and Artur Davis had been beaten by Earl Hillier, the African-American who held the congressional seat in Alabama. And so they were looked upon as kind of as traitors who had tried to unseat two incumbent African American elected officials. And of course, now a couple years later, they're on the winning side.
And Artur Davis was the first person to come out to support Barack Obama.
Yes, he was
as congressman in from Birmingham, Alabama. And what do you think your analysis of the divide between the Joshua and Moses generation, the gerontocracy and the youth? Mm-hmm. In the black political world, I mean, given the Andrew Young statements that you quoted in your book about what he said about Barack Obama and all the rest, and
how in Chicago they say we don't want nobody's sent.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so different in lots of ways in the African American political community. They didn't know who he was. I mean, Andrew Young would go on to say, "I just don't know. I know people in Chicago, and they don't know him." Well, that wasn't strictly true. I had other black leaders say the same thing to me at that point in time before Barack Obama had really seized the moment. And there was a lot of skepticism. And there was also a lot of loyalty to the Clintons. I think if Barack Obama had been running against someone else, the questions wouldn't have been so great and so deep. John Lewis, the congressman from Georgia, being the best example. He initially came out and supported the Clintons and, you know, did what Bill Clinton asked, especially. And then at some point looked around and felt, oh, my goodness, history is passing me by. I'm on the wrong side.
Mm-hmm.
And in someone less iconic than John Lewis, we would have called it a flip-flop.
That's right.
but because it was John Lewis, we thought, well, you know, maybe there's something going on here. And there was. And it was also personified in people like Joseph Lowery, but not in people like Ron Dellums, who stayed with the Clintons. It was an interesting dilemma for a lot of older black officials who didn't feel like Barack Obama had done what you usually do, which is come and kiss the ring and ask for support. He hadn't done that, and they resented it for a while until they saw he was winning, because they are politicians. They came around.
And what about people who were maybe outside the the political process in terms of running for office, like Ben Jealous.
Mm-hmm.
In his 30s, new head of the NAACP, and the role and how you might, in your conversations with him, have think about how he may transform the direction and even notion of what the NAACP means and where it goes in this new, more complex world.
Well, I think it's clear he's got a tough job. I mean, the NAACP's success was only based on political acumen. Lots of people would have been able to set it on the right course.
Right.
And perhaps a fresh new voice. I mean, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, he's the first head of the the NAACP who was not either an elected official or
an ordained minister. Right.
And so he now is now freighted with the responsibility to take an entirely new approach to what this organization's mission is, what its execution is, how you raise money for it, especially in a down economy. And he has to do it over the skepticism of, you know, some members of the NAACP's immense board of directors. But, you know, he's young and he's energetic, and it may be just what the organization needs.
I want to talk a bit about one of the other men you write about extensively in the book, and Cory Booker.
Mm-hmm.
Reading the chapter you had on him, it's a very complex man, especially in terms of people looking at him as perhaps going too far, too fast, and not understanding the realpolitik of his job,
mm-hmm.
And how hard he is charging ahead.
Cory Booker and Deval Patrick have that in common.
Mm-hmm.
They came into office very idealistically, thinking, okay, I'm just going to turn everything upside down and change it. And they forget that the reason things don't change over time, there's a reason for it. There is an entrenched way of doing things in a lot of governing situations, and you do have to kiss a couple of rings. You do have to find a way through the morass. Cory Booker walked into the city of Newark. He was raised in the suburbs. In fact, his parents had integrated a lily white suburb in New Jersey. But when he got his degrees and he got his background, he wanted to save something, and he came into Newark to save it. Except there were a lot of folk there, no matter how tough a place Newark was, who weren't particularly interested in being saved by this outsider, by this kid. And so along the way, he stepped on toes. Along the way, he had events overtake him. Like the schoolyard murders of these young children shortly after he began. He had all these clear ideas about how he was going to transform the city, but reality kept getting in the way. Same thing happened with Patrick, except in his case, politics kept getting in the
mm-hmm.
way. Politics is not beanbag in Massachusetts. Just because you won the governor's office doesn't mean everybody steps aside and says, right this way, Mr. Governor.
That's right.
In fact, it was the opposite for him for quite some time.
We're talking with Gwen Ifill, and her first book is out, and we're talking about that book, The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama. This is, before I go back to your chapter on politics of identity, just a personal note. I mean, I was really flabbergasted when you were attacked when you were about to moderate the vice presidential debate as someone who couldn't be objective. Even though it might have been about the book, I always felt there was another piece of subtlety floating below that.
Well, you say that because you know me or you've known my work all these years.
Right.
I think that the people who were doing the attacking not only didn't know my work, but weren't particularly interested in knowing my work. I was just a tool that was being used to shake things up at a time when they were hoping to shake things up. They weren't particularly interested in whether I had a reputation, whether I'd even, for instance, 4 years earlier, moderated another debate without having done anything terrible to anyone. I was fortunate in that when all of this was going on, I was pretty much in a self-contained bubble. I cut myself off from all the blogging and all of the outrage, partly because I wanted to focus it on the job at hand, which was tough enough, partly because I had fallen at home and broken my ankle 2 days before the debate.
Oh, God.
I was pretty much concentrating on not being in pain and getting around, and which turned out to be a good way to be distracted, even though not a good way to get around. And I was always very clear that a couple things were true. One is that I had not yet written the chapter about Obama, so I didn't know what I thought
mm-hmm.
about him. And the other was that I knew that the book was about more than him, that it was about the things we've been talking about, and that the folks who were leading the most vigorous charge against me would never in a million years have been interested in reading a book like that. So they were finding a way instead to conveniently trash it and trash me. It didn't work, and I was fairly calm about it the whole time because I was fairly certain it would not work, and that the one thing that I knew would happen eventually is the book would come out and they would all file silent, and they have.
And they have, as they should. I think about, again, this going back to your chapter on the politics of identity, because I'm that in the conclusion, I'm so fascinated about how these things fit together and where the future may go. I when I talk to Sherilyn Ifill, your cousin, and mm-hmm. she talks to me about her dad, who she's talked about on the air, who was a self-identified race man.
Mine too.
And yours too.
They were brothers.
They were brothers, right. And they were very powerful men intellectually. From what I understand, I haven't met either one of them, but from what I understand, they were very powerful men intellectually. And so I'm thinking about that place and this new battle over the politics of identity that's taking place now. And it really is a very important discussion going on. Whether you look at what you wrote about John Lewis and saying that this was not a new question about are you black enough, or the question of the 2008 when the Black Congressional Caucus had the panel, does it matter if you are black, that you wrote about briefly?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm really interested and excited by this discussion about where this discussion takes the black community, but where it takes America.
Well, it's everywhere. I mean, think of the reason why Roland Burris is a senator today is because Bobby Rush appeared at a press conference and said, you need to pick this man to be Barack Obama's successor because you need a black man in the Senate.
Who's the former Panther and a congressman from Chicago that Barack ran against, right?
He's a former Black Panther. Burris is 71 years old. It was a throwback to the old way of thinking about politics and about race. So here we have this really interesting debate going on, but just the very mention of it scared so many white folk in the Senate that they said, okay, never mind.
Mm-hmm.
They just stepped back as far as they could and got out of the way, because the idea of talking about race or being accused of having a bias involving race scared them so badly that they just stepped out of the way, and now they're still coping months later with the fallout.
Yes.
But it's something that's never going to go away. That's why when people say to me things like, oh, well, we're post-racial now, or we can get past that. Now that we have Barack, we don't need to have discussion anymore. I get impatient because it is so clear we're not past it. You know, when you pick up and see cartoons about watermelons and dead monkeys, you don't not past it. And it doesn't mean that we can't now move to a place where we have a conversation where it's not always negative and accusatory. I think we can. In fact, I think if there's any good news to be had about what's going on right now in this country in the wake of Barack Obama's election, it's not that he can magically save the world or make us suddenly, you know, race neutral, but it's that we can have conversations which are less loaded. What Eric Holder was trying to do last week was initiate a talk about conversations about race, which were less loaded, but then by using the word coward, unfortunately, he ended up loading the gun a little
yes.
bit more, but only because people get defensive when they feel like someone has pointed the finger at them. But I still think that I still come away mostly hopeful that we can have a better conversation.
Your very last sentence in your book.
Yeah.
Perhaps breakthroughs are on the verge of becoming enough of a part of the national political landscape that at some point we will cease noticing them altogether.
It'd be nice.
It would be lovely. This has been, I almost called you Sherilyn. Gwen Ifill, it's been a pleasure to talk.
That would be a compliment. Thank you.
She is a great lady. Gwen Ifill, thank you so much. It's been
thank
a pleasure to talk with you. Take care and congratulations on the book.
Thanks.
Thank you. We've been talking to Gwen Ifill. The book is The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama.